Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. I am very happy to have returning guests, some very good friends of mine, Dave McLaren and Ron Moreno from G&L Guitars. And Steve Postel, who's been on the show a couple of times, and he's going to be demoing some of these interesting guitars. It's good to have all you guys back.
Good to be back. And, thank you for having us.
And be prepared. Steve will be, we'll talk a little more about his album, his solo album coming up, and also an album with the immediate family that he's playing with a great bunch of musicians in that. And so we'll talk a little more about that in a little while. But thank you guys for coming down and bringing some of these amazing guitars. They're so beautiful. This one especially, which we're going to talk about in a second. What I want to ask you and start out first, David, is what G&L was presenting so people get an idea what you guys were showing at NAMM. So give me a little bit of a perspective. What came out this year?
Well, I think that the coolest stuff for us is because 2020 is our 40th anniversary of the G&L brand.
Mm-hmm.
As I've explained, you know, before, what was the CLF research thing? That was the thing that gave birth to G&L.
Mm-hmm.
But G&L was the new brand in 1980. And so what we've been doing this year is like, okay, we're going to do stuff that kind of celebrates that heritage, the very forward-looking, innovative state that Leo Fender was in. I mean, he was really on a tear at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So he left us so much good stuff. And what we're trying to do is really reach in and find more things to kind of celebrate. You know, some, maybe some things that we hadn't had around for a while, or there are things that maybe weren't developed all the way and that we could complete. But I guess when your brand has been around for this long, and for me, it was like, I remember when we first got, you know, we were still the new kids. It was a new brand. It, you know, it was 11 years old when we took the helm. So, you know, it's difficult now for me to view it as like, wait, now we're an older brand.
Yeah.
I don't know if that doesn't sound like a good way to put it, you know, an old brand, but, you know, we've been around.
Well, we were talking a little bit earlier, and it's funny because the my bass I bought in like around 1985. It's 40 years.
It's 40 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you think you could be playing with people who are freaking awesome musicians, and they're way younger than your bass.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. So for us, I guess it is, as leading up to this, it's kind of a thing where sometimes you got to look back and kind of take stock of where did you come from. Try to do a more honest. Try to connect with your roots as honestly as you can, and then reassess where are we going forward. And that's something that I really think in the past couple of years, well, year and a half, couple of years, it's really been kind of gelling, where we really started to get a direction inspired by the tools and technologies Leo Fender gave us, and make the things that we're coming out with even more distinctive, more different than things you might find on the market. You know, less less like stuff that you could buy from other people, you know?
Well, it's amazing just how much he improved on the, you know, everybody. I mean, Fender was, isn't what he did at the Fender Company, the designs of the guitars, the Strat, the Tele, the bridges, the floating bridges, all that stuff, the pickups were revolution, and they were significant, obviously part of history. But what amazes me going and listening to these guitars is how much he improved the bridge style, like what you guys are using on the bridges, especially in the floating bridge. It's better. It's actually the next, which makes sense because he didn't sit and just rest on his laurels. He was constantly making it better, tinkering, you know, trying to make it a better thing. But same thing with the pickups. It just amazes me how much he improved what he originally had designed from the 50s to what he was doing in the 80s. It's to me amazing.
And there was kind of a neat thing in it, if you look at his business and personal life, where, you know, as we moved towards the mid 60s, so much of his time became occupied with just the management of the business, growing this thing. You know, so when he sold it, he was kind of hoping he'd get to play more and spend more time innovating. You know, that's what he really loved, the lab. That's what he wanted to do. But in a sense, once he was free with that, and then we sort of look at like Leo Fender 2.0, the CLF research post-Fender years, the stuff that he did, the original Music Mans and then the early G&L and stuff, this stuff was much more forward-looking than any of the stuff that Fender would have permitted him to do. So that's why we ended up with, you know, artifacts from the late 60s and during the last of his Fender years, but these things fizzled out because it kind of became clear that they were going in different directions. Leo was looking for a moonshot, and they weren't really interested in going that direction. So he bottled up some of that stuff. He was freed from having to manage the big company, and he had all the time in the world to innovate and really think. So it's really kind of cool that sort of the second chapter that happened at CLF Research, really he unleashed a torrent of things. And in fact, some of the things, he was coming at so many of the things quickly in the 80s that really the market couldn't even absorb these things. Dealers could get quickly confused because there's new things. You couldn't communicate things very quickly, you know, to explain why, hey, why should you carry this? Well, it's like this, but it's got this benefit. So a lot of the things that he left us, it's like, well, we can revisit those things. Maybe there's some things that we can modify about it or tweak it or a little bit and make it really cool. But I look at it as like there's this big box of fun stuff that's really cool that we can unpack. Mm-hmm. And some of this stuff, like in the case of that guitar, it wasn't done. We got to finish it, which I love. It's like like finding a song that had been written, it's not completed, and it was from long ago. And maybe the artist died 30 years later, but you find this old song, and you know what this artist did in their later years, and you can go, I can finish this song in a style they would have liked. And that is a wonderful opportunity for us to look through Leo Fender's things and get to try to complete them, if you will, or improve them.
It's hard for me sometimes to wrap my head around the fact that this guitar was designed 40 years ago. 40 years in the 80s. I'm trying to remember what was out at that time. And
that's the one that was going to be the moonshot. You know, that was intended to be a Fender, but sort of like the premium 2-pickup model. You know, this would have been sort of like Telecasters here, and then here's our premium one. But, you know, the technology was getting, it was too advanced, it wasn't ready. It was kind of clear that, especially as you look at like 1968, Leo was really trying to push the envelope. At the same time, what CBS really particularly needed him for was just operational things to keep things going, you know?
So he designed this in the 60s, he's even older.
Yes. This is from the earliest days of CLF research.
This is in like the late 60s. Think about what was out at that time, musically and guitar-wise. And he was already thinking about this, and and some of it needed the technology to catch up so that
right.
we could do
but
it.
Even the prototypes that you know, the artifacts that we have and the drawings and so forth, all of which existed. And the fact is that as we started tunneling into it, we're finding more and more of them. It was almost like Leo wanted to just go, hey, by the way, here. You know, it felt like, the ghost stories where somebody just throws something in front of you and mm-hmm. then I found it. It was like, once we started looking, it's like I'm finding some things that I'm certain I've never even seen before. And it's like, it just made it easy. The only difficult thing was working on the electronics. This is where everything wins or loses. It's very easy to make something that looks like that, but for it to accomplish the objectives that we want tonally, that's a tough thing because we're charting new territory. Where Leo left it wasn't anywhere near done, but you could see it was the glimpse of the moonshot where
yeah.
pickups were going to be lower output. It was going to be the signal is going to be received by a little buffer preamp that's going to be powered by 9 volts. You know, so this is 60s time.
Yeah, there was nothing like that.
Well,
at that time.
Talk about that's a 9 volt battery now, but when you found it, what was in it?
The prototype ones, they actually have a little cartridge in the back that would hold AA batteries. If you could imagine those plastic things and you'd shove a bunch of AA batteries in it, and maybe there'd be like the 9-volt tab you'd stick on there. And what we think is, okay, given the time that was developed, 1967 and 68 was where a lot of the electronic technology was developed. 1969 is where the styling was developed for it. But 67 to 68, what we think that was the era particularly in America, where the transistor radio was popularized. Everybody, all the kids on the beach had this little radio.
I had one.
And, the transistor radios were powered by the little rectangular batteries, the 9-volt batteries, which is why at the time we all called them transistor batteries. They didn't have transistors in them, but, you associate it with
right.
that. Oh, what kind of battery? A transistor battery, right? But we suspect that Leo was looking and going, okay, those are becoming widely available, but if we're going to give this instrument to musicians that are touring, they have to know that they can get batteries anywhere. And so achieving it with AA batteries, yeah. 6 of them is a bit clunkier, but everywhere, every liquor store, every general store, and every place you're going to pass through will have those batteries. 9 volts, maybe
not as much,
maybe
yeah.
not.
That's right. It's interesting. One thing I want to mention is, if you're not already, follow the GNL on Instagram and Facebook, because besides posting some great pictures of guitars they just made that they're shipping out to the stores, you guys are doing a great job just showing pictures of the documents.
Oh, okay. If you want to know where the weird stuff is, so there's our main at GL Guitars or whatever, on Facebook and Instagram. But where I put the weird stuff is, this is like all the old documents, old tools, just stuff that's not like general interest stuff. That we put, it's called at CLF Research, which is CLF Research stands for Clarence Leo Fender Research. And that's the name of our company, which is really first,
right.
That's the umbrella, if you will, where once Leo sold his Fender company, moved out, but continued to work for him. So that was sort of like the first act of CLF Research. Act two was build this factory and design and make the first music band instruments.
Right.
That was just, from 76 to 80. And then from 80 forward was sort of the third phase with the G&L brand.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the design drawings that he did. And the wiring diagrams, and you show all that stuff. It's cool. I mean, some of the bills for parts and stuff, it's really interesting stuff.
And I like thinking that, as we find more and more of the artifacts from the late 60s, is to realize that he was really into the moonshot thing. He wanted to push really next level. And I think part of that is he thought, he has to compete, but also he saw the likes of, the imports. I think we talked about that before. Fearing if we don't innovate, there's going to be difficulty to compete. right? So that we have to compete on the performance merits of this instrument. It has to do some cool stuff or innovative stuff, or it has to do something better because they're going to catch up, you know? So he was looking for a real next phase. And again, his techniques were always, his approach was always problem solving.
Right.
That's why we looked at, well, why did that guitar have the little split coil? Just to naturally eliminate the 60 cycle hum.
Right.
No weird stuff, just, as he called it, the percussive his Fender sound, but no 60 cycle hum. So that was a tick box. Then the next thing was, okay, I can't control very much via my cord, long cord, loading, changes the sound. So the next thing was problem solving. Well, if we could have just this robust little preamp on there. Nothing fancy, just a little preamp on there.
Right.
It'll receive the signal from the pickups, and it can send a nice, you know, buff signal down there. To, you know, so never, don't worry about the cord. I'm just going to shove it right down that
right, cord. Right, because at 68, around 68, a lot of effects pedals started starting into the market.
Well, long cords.
Long cords.
And the amps, the amps were getting more powerful and later in the 70s, the gain stages became more critical.
Everything was getting loud, and he saw that coming in terms of what was happening musically. So he had already reacted prior to on dealing with the situation. He put it on the guitar.
So yeah. We sort of look at it as sort of like, really, what was going on under really the CLF research era? It was sort of him responding culturally to the change in the music and the things that he created later. It was, I call it sort of Leo Fender when the music got loud, because that was the period. Before then, you know, imagine up to like 65 or so, there's some, things really got loud after that, right? Music's changed, and it's like, okay, he's thinking in his moonshot, my instruments are going to have to change for a new age. You know, you could look around and see people using his instruments to push the envelope, but he's thinking, I need to give new tools to these people to aid them in pushing the envelope, right? We're going to push the envelope. We're not going to fly the same planes. At some point, we're going to fly better planes.
Yeah. I wonder what he thought of, like, Hendrix when he was, like, all that feedback and stuff. That must have been interesting to see what he thought about that, because that changed everything.
Yeah.
It's not something he'd listen to at home, but he respected and appreciated what people did. So he had a neat thing about where he liked his music, but he got a great way to appreciate music that it wasn't his deal at all.
Right.
Because what he could appreciate is the passion that went into that. And him coming from the technical side, here he was not the musician, you know, barring his little saxophone. You know, he wasn't.
Right.
So there was an element of him that longed for to be able to connect in some way with that spiritual experience that he could see his tools inspired in musicians, right? So he thought he was making tools for the angels, so to speak, you know? Or at least that's how Phyllis would describe it.
Right, right, right.
Did he have a relationship at all with Hendrix? Did they... I mean, Hendrix is so identified
more,
with the Strat.
More than likely would have crossed paths, but that...
But it wouldn't have...
I mean, he was Leo Fender, so all kinds of people would be crossing his paths. And even if you look at, like, at the late 60s, he was still working closely with Fender CBS, so people coming through and people would want to meet Leo Fender, you know.
I think, from what I understand, is, like, one of his main haunts was, like, Manny's Music, and he would just order, like, 5-6 Strats, and they would send them to him. And he would just, because he was touring all the time.
Yeah.
Or in the studio, because he recorded moreover in New York.
But that time, too, Hendrix took off. So, you know, he wasn't here.
Yeah,
you know,
he was in England a lot, too. But when he was here, he was more in New York. So, unless he was touring the estate. So, he wasn't around in L. He wasn't an L.A. guy.
Right.
You know what I mean?
There's that, the whole Manny's thing, that's insane. That's insane history. That's where we're sort of like, there's this retail part of our business, you know, the business of selling products to musicians. But in the case of Manny's, it's like, it was such a cultural institution, the people that came through it, it's like, it was like a cool club. You know what I mean? If you think of a cool club where bands played, that level of coolness, Manny's kind of had that. You know, the walls.
Well, I was there in the late 70s. I was touring and we went to visit there and I bought a phase shifter or whatever in there just to say I bought something from there, and they had it was a multi-story place, And they had like this conveyor belt thing that they'd hang guitars on and bring it down from storage upstairs. So I'm standing there ready to pay for my thing, and I see this thing come down, and four Les Pauls come down, and there's, and it says on their little note, for Jeff Beck. They sent them out.
Well, I got my first guitar in 1969.
Very cool.
And I ended up, the thing was, you became friends. I was friends with Henry, I was friends with his kids. I played at Henry's house at a cocktail party, and it was a club. It was absolutely, yeah. There's never been a kid in a candy store experience like early Manny's was for us. It was amazing. Yeah. I still have the guitar, too.
History. My parents lost a little bit of history when they closed Manny's.
My parents were good friends with the Goldriches. Oh, yeah. You know, that goes way back to then. Very nice people.
Yeah. No, it was an amazing place. I never saw so much stuff in my life.
Great business people and tough and stuff, but very, very kind human people. So I just vaguely remember them from being, you know, a child, but my parents being friends with them.
Now, I know that we talked before when we had the show where we did, and you guys can go in the archives to check it out, when we talked about the Doheny, and that was another one where you kind of did more research and went a little bit beyond and made this pickup that's just amazing pickup. And the same thing here. So you've, because I'm trying to get a kind of feel of where you're going now with the company, because you went beyond what Leo's vision was on the pickup on this.
Well, the prototypes as it was left, to say the project.
Right.
The project was dead at the end of 1969. In fact, it was kind of funny to see the, you know, these styling drawings going very, like, they were really pushing to get into November, into December 69, and then it just stops. I guess there was some hope still that there was some kind of project, some instrument would get turned in, but it just wasn't happening. So when we decided that we were going to bring this out and you know, finish it, we had, like I said, you know, we had the benefit of his tools and technologies from later years.
Right.
So really, the bridge solution was easy. We didn't have to figure out that contraption on there. He'd already solved the problems. Mm-hmm. He had the saddle lock bridge. So, no problem. The pickups, we could see some of the stuff he was trying to do with this extra little, you know, phasey switch on there. But it was, you know, when somebody's just taking a stab at a new kind of riff and style, and it's just not there yet, but you can kind of get a glimpse of where they're, what they're stabbing at.
Right, right.
And you go, okay, well, I could see that. Now, if we used your magnetic field design technology you did later, I think that's kind of, that might work. So then once we applied a later technology and then started working with the normal variables we might, like, you know, the aperture, how wide is this space you're going to wind the wire around, and, you know, what the wire gauge is and turns and, you know, size of the magnet, that kind of, you know,
yeah,
the routine stuff. We started to figure out, hey, can we get this to do the standard sort of series, you know, when you got these little split coil things like you would like with a precision bass.
Yeah, go ahead, hold this up so they can see
it. You know, the signal, let's say we look at the neck pickup, the signal might go through one. The neck pickup is really two separate pickups, really. So the signal kind of goes through one coil, then it goes through the other one, and then it comes out. That's sort of the typical thing. It gives you a little bit of a warmer, fatter sound. Each one of those little pickups could operate sort of independently with their own little positive and negative, right? Now, if we take the leads of one of those and take the leads of the other ones next to it and just join them like railroad tracks... Joining.
Right.
This probably, what the hell am I doing with this?
No, that's okay. It's on
coming
Facebook
together.
Live. He's explaining on Facebook Live.
Forgive me. It can give it a completely different sound, but that's often gets a little bit of phase cancellation or a lot of phase cancellation. So they don't typically do that. But with the magnetic field design pickup, we have this nice fat field where, yes, it can sound really nice and thick and rich with the series, but with parallel, rather than, in the case of Leo Fender's earlier attempt from the late 60s, when we tried those as parallel, they almost just disappeared. There was just this little plinky-plink thing from distant Mars or something, you know? So we thought, hey, we can just apply the tools and technology that he left us and just tinker around at the edges of it, because we got a feeling it's going to work. And if we can give you series and parallel on a switch and they're really good, that was the end game. And then I had my doubts, but that's when my brother, as I told you, he's the super geek. So I get stuck where it's like, I don't know how we're going to get out of this jam, you know, with something, you know, maybe it's, I don't know. And then he keeps going at it. And then he comes back with something else, like when we did that Doheny V12 with, you know, the MFD Jazzmaster humbuckers. Early on, I thought those things were just a dumpster fire. It was just, I had no idea. It was just so far off. And so I didn't even want to play with it for a while. And then my brother's the one that keeps poking at it. And then he brings it back until inspiration is like, oh, we're back on.
Yeah.
And this was the same sort of thing. I'd get all up on the concept, what would be great if it could do. And then my brother is the guy who made it do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look so they understand what the parallel sound. Let's mm-hmm. go through the sounds and the setup of this guitar, the Espada. Now, the 40th anniversary,
we had the 40th anniversary custom shop Espada, and also the L2000, which looks basically identical to this. And then in the team-built stuff, we did the 40th anniversary with an S500, which we have here, and an SB1.
Okay.
So this one would be the custom shop. And this has a roasted flame maple neck, 3A flame.
Go ahead and hold it up.
Quilted maple top, and an Akume body for the back.
Go ahead and flip it. Yeah, you can see.
Yeah.
Also has this cool. This is a cool.
Yeah.
That's Leo Fender's string retainer.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Love it.
Because what he wanted to do with that is. Another little problem-solving thing is when people started getting into bending behind the nut, you know, a lot of country guys, you know, double stop or doing this stuff, and then the string comes out from under the string tree, and they're like, oh, crap, you know, get it back under there. Mm. So what this is it's applying downward pressure, but the strings are all captive, so they can't come unhooked from a string tree.
Right, right. Yeah.
And it also has this nice little slight radius on the bottom of it, so it keeps the strings from kind of hanging up.
Am I right, or is this a straighter line through than on the typical, or is it with the string tree? Isn't there usually a little more of an angle there?
Well, if it's straight, it's only because
it's pulling it down, but it doesn't look like it's angled back like a Gibson. No.
It's a nice. Yeah.
That's just good engineering.
Now this one's a hardtail, but can you get it with a tremolo?
In the custom shop, but this is the model that as is.
Well, let's take a listen to the pickups. Let's go through the different sounds and see what the tone of this thing is great.
So okay, we'll take it. So this has
he's passive now. So
passive,
no.
And then
should we just like should we do a quick point to what the controls are?
Yeah, sure.
So the big selector is your pickup selector, you know, this the normal guy there.
Right.
And your knobs are volume, treble, and bass. And the bass is really cool, so if you have like a kind of a something too heavy, too thick, you can lean it out.
I will when I'm soloing, I roll this off a little bit. Yeah.
And then we have the two little mini toggles. The mini toggle at the white at the front, I don't know if anybody can see that. That's the one that controls that series or parallel. That's the route the signal takes through those pickups.
So here's this one.
That's the parallel.
Yeah. And then you kick it in and you get series.
That's a great sound, that parallel.
That's that switch, and then this is the preamp.
That is the preamp control, and it has the three positions. So one is preamp off, so that you can play it completely passive, and that is that's kind of a big deal because when Leo Fender had some difficulties with his active circuits that were dedicated active, you know, that's the thing where if something goes wrong, the show doesn't go on. In this case, if you turn it off, everything else works. Volume, treble, bass, no problem. The flight continues.
You can take the battery out.
Yeah,
and run it.
Yeah.
Well, and the pickups are hot enough.
Yeah, they don't need help.
Right. Yeah, they don't really.
But we wanted to put it in there because Leo Fender would have put it in there as ticking that box, that problem solving. So this thing spiritually, it had to have that, mm-hmm. you know? So the middle position is just buffer preamp on. So
here's clean. Now we turn it on. It's louder and fatter. And then what's the last one?
The top one is the preamp's on with a little extra high-end EQ kick.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the middle one. Oh yeah.
That's particularly cool. Let's say you're doing something with the fuzz pedal and things are all kind of thick, you know. Mm. Well, you could do a couple things with this thing. You could use the preamp with kick up the treble to help cut through, and you could also roll down bass. Some of bass.
Right.
So your ability to play in fuzz land, it's like a whole new box of toys to play
with. Well, and another thing too is because the pickups are so hot, you can. Like a lot of guys, you see this a lot with acoustic guitar players. They'll use a clean boost. So when they go to solo, they just kick it, and then they go back to the mm-hmm. other thing. So mm-hmm. you can do it from there, actually.
Yeah. So here's with a little distortion. Turn this down a little bit. Here's with brighter.
It's got plenty of juice.
And all this mucking around is just one pickup so far.
Right, that's right. We're just
we're using the neck pickup.
Right.
And it gets a good, I love the sound. Let's go through where both of the pickups, it gets that kind of a cool telly sound.
So let's turn this back off, keep it in. Take it off of this setting, back to this.
And that's a regular
structure.
Now, what happens when you put it in parallel? Do they both go in parallel?
Yeah, they both are doing the same thing. So either both. So that parallel series parallel switch controls what both of those pickups are doing, whether you're using both pickups or not.
Right.
Yeah. Now listen to what he's doing there. Now he has both pickups on, and he's in parallel. He has character to the tone.
There's this neat air and jangle that there's shades of an acoustic guitar in there, but not in any kind of a spiky, fakey kind of way.
Oh, it's nice.
But it has kind of a, what we call with tellies, that spank to it. It just bites. It cuts.
Now if you switch it into here, you get all that extra. We are listening to just so everyone knows to a 3-inch speaker.
Yeah, he's playing in this little guy right here. There's this little tiny amp here. That's great. It sounds great.
So it's cool, but we're not getting the full. But that's so when what I do when I set it up, I set my amp so that with everything off, it sounds great. So I would set it up for this sound. No preamp, and then if I want to boost it up, I've got it.
So right now, what he was saying in this, he had it set so it was in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
It's in parallel now. Then he kicks in the, takes it out of phase, takes the out of phase out.
Yeah,
and then he gets that extra meat.
If you set it up, if you set your amp with it already like this, then you might feel a little anemic when you go back to parallel.
Right. Right.
So I start with everything off on my guitars, and then get a real nice sound out of the amp.
Yeah.
Then this all really becomes fun, including the tone controls.
And that's a great way to do that, because where Leo Fender was looking at giving you more control from the instrument, ideally, you know, it was just try to spare you from running back and forth to your amplifier. It's like we could do more on this instrument. This instrument is just something that I think. There's no way it could have come out with all that much switchy stuff on it. We just picked up the project, and then rather than completing it a way that we think he would have, having a sales department to tell him there's too many switches. So we completed, it was like, damn the torpedoes, we're just going to do what we're going to do. And because it does this well, we're going to put these other switches on there, and I think people can deal with it. And I was...
Well, back then,
they
didn't know. There wasn't that much out. Also, you have to understand, like with active electronics became more of an issue because it functions like a buffer amp for pedal boards. All the pedals hadn't come out yet. You didn't see phase shifters. You didn't see flangers and all that. They hadn't been made yet. It was just a fuzz tone, a couple of fuzz tones, and maybe a just a drive boost. And that was about it. There was, you know, there wasn't really a lot of stuff out at that time. I think there was the Maestro phase shifter, but there wasn't really the Wah-Wah was the other thing.
Yeah.
And but yeah, there wasn't a lot. And customizing guitars and all that stuff happened later in the 70s where you, and this kind of stuff, it was definitely ahead of its time. Because all of this stuff that you're doing here was what they would do. Like Jerry Garcia, when he had all those Alembics modified, they did all of this stuff. And that's where a lot of that stuff was coming from. And some of the other guitar players of the time, they were modding and changing their guitars. So it's interesting. And this was like, you know, the basic design was in 68. I mean, it was 67, 68. I think Albert Lee said he put a humbucker on his telly, which became a fad. And he might have been the first one. We don't know for sure. But you know what I'm saying? It's like that's where everybody was at that time.
But these canceled them, right? Because they're... Yeah.
Yeah, but there's just, you can get away with it because there's so much innate strength to those pickups. Right. It's a nice, fat, magnetic field around those coils. It lets you get away with it. Actually, sometime when you come by, we could plug in Leo's prototype one. Oh, so you can go, okay, you could see, this is where it really stopped.
Yeah.
It's the one that we have operating isn't shaped like that with the styling, but the technological part that he was working on is complete. So you can kind of see, where did this thing stop?
Yeah.
And the part is then just like, you know, I can kind of see maybe he was displeased with that. And then you see the clock run out. And I can, and it's really neat when you look and play with the artifacts. You could start to fill in a little bit, probably what happened.
Yeah, and where he was aiming to go, which I think, like this guitar and the Doheny, I think you pushed it beyond probably what you, at that point, Leo was thinking, you went beyond it to an extent,
the way I think of it is Leo unleashed. So the sales department would tell him, he's like, oh, too many switches, you know, back to any time, just too many. But we figured if we're going to break this out, we're going to do it the way he would do it if nobody could tell him otherwise.
Right.
And he's going to tell you why these are switches on here and why these are important and valuable to you.
Yeah.
Not fluff.
Yeah, no, that's true.
When I went down there the first time, I'm sure you do this to everybody, you come in this room, and you walk in this room, it's just an inch full of dust, and it's
his shop. Oh, his office, yes.
And the newspapers are there from the... It's a really wild experience. Danny Korshmer and I walked in there, it's just an incredible experience to think of what happened.
Yeah, and he had these slabs of wood with a neck bolted on it. Mm-hmm. And he could slide the pickup, so he would listen to find the best spot for the pickup. Mm-hmm.
It was his sort of quick and dirty way of pickup testing, positioning.
It's inventive. I mean, it's brilliant for what he did, and it got the job done.
He was all about the elegant solution. You know, if it's simple and effective,
that's
what he liked.
Real quick, go through the treble, the bridge pickup, and then we'll go on to the other guitar. There's so much to look at. That's now with the parallel.
And that's series?
Yep.
That's regular, series. And parallel, it's jangling.
Now parallel.
And then it's kicking the... That's with the preamp and the bright, the extra bright.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so you can see on this guitar, I mean, there's a lot of tonal possibilities. Just with two pickups, you'd think that, you know, like a Strat would give you more, but you're getting everything there. And the parallel thing really gives you some other, takes you some other places.
Yeah. That was the hardest part to do, because you have to find a balance where this would work in series, nicely in series and parallel. That was really the kind of, for me, the moonshot part, and where I was stuck. And that's where I, when I started to tap out, there's my brother who will grab the thing, and he'll come out the other side with something, and it's like, oh, here we go. Let's keep going.
Let's say, as a player who likes color, once you have this capacity, it's really hard to not have it.
Yeah.
Once you can go the parallel series thing and have all those different tonalities out of a pickup, I really miss it when I don't have it. You know, it's great.
It spoils you. It does. How did I play guitar? One guitar without this?
That's why so many of the models at that in the G&L thing had that, you know, including the basses.
Yeah.
But you got to design it. Technically, you could take any guitar, slap a pickup on it, you know, a switch in it, but it does not mean that this is going to produce something good. It will electrically work.
What other guitars besides the Spada have that type of circuitry? We have the parallel series and the boost. Are there any other models?
Nothing currently that's not a bass.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's not a bass.
Although I put it in my Skyhawk. And it's fantastic.
Oh, you should have that circuit like that. You can do that.
I can do that.
Yeah. But, you know, I think this was also a little bit of a test, because, you know, to see if are people going to be cool with us putting a preamp in this guitar. You know, it's not sort of a necessity like if we have, like, you know, an EMG pickup or something, you know, that kind of thing, you know, where it's very much part and parcel, the pickup and the preamp. You know, it's quite a different thing than what this is. This guitar doesn't need the preamp.
Yeah,
it could operate without, but it opens doors for you.
Yeah.
So I just didn't know if that was going to be well received, but it's kind of weird. The people dig it.
The parallel series thing, I think, is, to me, as a player, is more critical because it gives you so many more tones. And I think on the humbucker Doheny, the one with the actual, that has that on it, right?
Oh, that's true. I forgot about that. That was also a difficult fight to find that balance.
Right. I remember that because you got that. But this is more dramatic, I think.
Well, this has the preamp. That one doesn't have.
Well, no,
preamp.
But he's been showing it without the preamp, and it's still amazing.
This one was harder to do because you don't. The other one, even if you had a little bit of phase cancellation, the humbucker went from one end to the other. And this one, if you start to lose that phase cancellation, it's not like it could be made up somewhere else.
Right, 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 right.
You know, so it was basically there's this little mysterious little void where stuff starts to phase cancel, and you're trying to find this balance where it comes out cool and you're not missing too much stuff. It doesn't sound anemic, you know?
Yeah.
You want to have your cake and eat it too, but also when you put it in series, it's not a forest fire.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look at, we got about 10, 12 minutes, so I want to kind of go through as many as we can, because they brought some great guitars. So, now, the next one, I think, is yours, Steve?
This is mine, which is
a Skyhawk. With
I just got to thank you, but the reason I know these guys is because of you.
Oh, that's right. He had called me, he was going to Japan, and he needed a guitar to take with him to Japan. And so I called Ron, and I said, let me check out and see. And the rest is history.
Yep.
Yeah, and I just to what I love about, you know, I'm sitting here listening to you, and you have a joy in this whole process. Like, how can we make this tool? So you've carried on what I think was his legacy, which was making tools for people. And I felt, as soon as I went down there, I felt like. Because I wasn't sure, you know, I needed a few things, and I'd much rather work with people who really want to.
Well, they're players and they're enthusiasts too.
So I appreciate the relationship a lot, and the guitars are amazing. But this has become most of us, the touring thing has become more and more difficult as travel has gotten more difficult. So a lot of times we each can take one guitar, and then we rent something. Or in your, if you guys know someone in New York, you had a guy bring, which was really nice, in Japan. So this ended up being the guitar now. If I can bring one guitar, it's the Skyhawk. And I did do a little mod, which was that both of these I can do the parallel series thing. And that way I can get almost a Strat thing, and then I can pop it down. It gives me all the colors.
So it's parallel in series, not split coil.
Yes, not split. That's right. But it's really a warm guitar. And that's not, you know, like it's not too thin and bright on that. So I usually start out, I keep this one in that, and then I have the option. So like if I want a little boost, I just kick it in. I keep this one in humbucker most of the time.
So this guitar is passive.
Passive, but still.
Now, is that a hardtail or is that a full vibrato?
That's a fulcrum.
What did we do?
You blocked it.
We blocked it.
Because he was,
I do a lot of tunings. I do slide, I do a lot of tunings. So I need to be able to...
What's the wood? Now, this is a... Is it rosewood?
This is a Kumi and a Caribbean rosewood.
Caribbean rosewood.
And it has, it's just an incredible neck to play. Really, really smooth. So this is the one that I take when I can only bring one.
Okay.
If I can bring two, then I bring this. And to really get some other colors, this.
Now, was this the one they gave you when you first met?
This is the one I went to. The first one I took to Japan.
Okay. Tell me what's on this guy.
This is a straight up ASAT classic with the ash body.
I mean, that's a beautiful Tele sound.
Yeah, that's this. So this is a standard model. There's no mods, nothing done to this.
I just wanted a Tele, I love these sort of semi-satin finish.
Mm. So yeah. It's a satin on the body too.
I just love it. It feels great. The place is not too thin on it.
The tone on it's killer.
Together.
But even with the MFD pickups, if you want to like start to take it a little bit more old school, if you just roll off the volume, just 10 to 9.
Yeah.
You know, from 10 to 9, there's something that just opens up a little bit.
If you take both of these, the little volume off and a little tone off. So that's how I take this back to, I don't know, you'd say 8.5, and this 8.5. Then I set my amp.
Yeah.
So I set the amp so that sounds great. Then I can...
Then you get that a little more when you want it.
Yeah. Now, is that both pickups right now that you're set up?
That's both, yeah.
Yeah, it's got that spade. It just has a spade.
And then this one. So that's that one.
That's a beautiful one.
Beautiful, yeah.
So that's a great sounding guitar. Period.
And I should break out this this crazy guy.
Okay.
Look at this.
That's the ASAT Z3. That's a custom shop one because it doesn't have the saddle lock bridge, but it has the vibrato and the fulcrum.
And it's, I love this neck. It's flame.
Yeah, it's got a 3A flame neck.
So this has three of these.
Yep.
What do you call these?
A Z coil. they're underneath the Z shape molded cover. They're two separate coils.
So it's like the Espada,
but a little bit
of different. Recipe.
Yeah, they're not the the aperture and those other variables are different, but two little offset coils. Yeah, they share that.
Yeah. So basically, you still have a single coil, but it can't does a lot of hum canceling.
But this sounds
ingenious.
Basically, by doing the two little coils, one of them is reverse wound, reverse polarity. So that's the thing. So where it's just going to knock out that 60 cycle hum.
Right.
So it's when they call it split coil, it's two coils. But thinking about it, it's like instead of having one, I'm going to kind of split it up. So one of them might kind of invert. So when we put these things together,
there goes the that.
Yeah.
That's the reasoning. Yeah.
So you get that you have a five position switch.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
The push pull does the same thing like that S500 guitar we were talking about. You know, where the neck and the bridge or the all three.
Neck and the bridge.
This is these guys.
Yep.
Yeah.
All three. In the middle. Back to a five way.
That's great.
But I love this sound. This is a great sound, which is the...
Well, it's the Telly sound.
Yep. The
bridge
skip,
in the neck.
Skipping the middle. Beautiful. And then back to just... possibly.
No, that's a great guitar, fantastic. Too. And that's Ash?
Yeah,
that's Ash.
Nice piece too. Look at that. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have one more, right? We have one more to show. I know I'm rushing. We're going to run out of time.
The traditional stack.
Yeah, you have the 40th anniversary in the S500.
Okay, let's take a look at that.
That's this one.
Oh, that's a beaut.
Wow, what a color!
Yeah, what's the woods on this?
That's a Kume.
And this has this same thing.
Yep. Right.
Yeah,
we just call it Leo's expander switch.
So that way brings us one in, right? So
yeah, this is just our modern S500 with just a couple of little tweaks. The Okume Mahdi, the trans red was something that we started doing in the 80s, so it's a bit of a heritage thing for us to have. Okume we use these days is like it's our modern mahogany,
right?
You know, it's like it's lighter. It's from the Savannah.
It's nice that you can see the grain.
Yeah,
great way.
So it gets the vibe without being a tank.
Yeah. But this you have that same thing, right? So if I this is these two, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Three.
Wait. Is that it's supposed to be the other way? That guy.
Play.
Yeah, that's the neck and bridge.
All three.
That's nice.
This guitar has a nice middle pickup on its own.
Yeah.
Sure is.
Let's see. The other thing we did with it is we used our early, what we call our early CLF headstock. That headstock was actually for the first G&L instruments.
Oh, really?
It started in 1980. And on the back, they have some Klusen tuners. At the time, Leo had Schaller make them, but Schaller doesn't have anything like that now. But those Klusens, they take you back, approximately to the period for the vibe.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, we're out of time. Real quick, it's www.glguitars.com is the website for you guys. And I really want to, real quick... let everybody know what you're doing and the immediate family are doing.
The immediate family is a band with myself, Wadi Wachtel, Danny Korchmar, Leland Sklar, and Russ Kunkel. Very guitar-oriented band.
And Danny's using the Doheny.
Yeah, no shortage of talent there, right?
Oh, God.
I just quickly, because we're ending when Keith Richards came to see us, because you know Wadi was in his band, at the end of the night, he waved me over and he said to me, you know what's better than two guitars? I said, what? He goes, three guitars.
And so when can people, I know your albums are coming out in Japan.
We're going to play the Troubadour on, I think, April 6th. Keep an eye out for that because that's going to go in a day. They're doing a documentary. The guy, Denny Tedesco, who did The Wrecking Crew, is doing a documentary on the whole history of all of us and all the history of the...
He's good. He was on the show. What he did for his dad was amazing.
Yeah, and then we have a new record that comes out in... the EP comes out in June, and the record comes out in September, and the documentary comes out in October.
Okay, so you can expect them to be here on the show, because we'll be talking about that as it comes out. I want to thank you, Steve, for coming down and playing for us. And you guys, Dave and Ron.
Got a little gift for you there.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay, this card, you can't see it, but it's the G&L Musical Products, but it says Leo Fender President.
That's one of his business cards.
That's awesome.
Part of my G&L collection of history, historical facts. Anyway, I want to thank you guys, and we're going to be doing some more stuff with G&L. We'll be talking about some more stuff, and I definitely have to go and do a... it's always a blast with you guys. But I definitely want to come down and do some stuff over at Leo's Lounge.
Yep.
That's the cool... Tell them real quick what that is as I start the music up.
Leo's Lounge, we just basically took a spot in the middle of the company. We built a stage, and we got gear there. So it's for us to be able to test stuff. That's how we rationalize it. Mostly it's just for us to goof off. So we can go down there. We can do as much noise as we want. We have fun.
Yes, I'm gonna come down and bring. And we're gonna try all this stuff.
It's the ultimate like teen party hang.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you guys so much for being on, and I look forward to hearing the new album and the documentary. Everybody, we'll see you next week. Have a great week.
Thanks, everybody.
See ya. Thanks.